Iranian intent, but rather to focus on preparing sufficient military capability so that Israel would be able to eliminate Iranian nuclear capability altogether with a unilateral strike. This, of course, is no solution at all. Importantly, and quite scandalously, the Israeli regime is not the signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. It has repeatedly rejected calls to join the Keystone Accord of the International Arms Control Regime and refused to give United Nations Nuclear Agency, the IAEA inspectors, access to its nuclear sites. Despite the Israeli regime's dismissive approach, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has adopted a remarkably soft approach to the point that many see collusion between the two. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi's recent whirlwind trip to Tel Aviv, ahead of the United Nations Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors meeting in Vienna, lent credence to the plausible Israel-IAEA collusion theory. Rafael Grossi dashed off to Israel to discuss the anti-Iran resolution drafted by the United States and the European Troika with Israeli officials, aimed at mounting pressure on Iran to give up its legitimate demands. Does it make sense that the IAEA chief meets the head of an illegitimate regime which has secretly built a nuclear arsenal and refused to cooperate with the United Nations agency, the IAEA, to discuss the nuclear program of a country that has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, cooperated fully with the agency, and fulfilled all of its obligations? It smells of something deeply sinister and extremely despicable. Therefore, the West must accept the inevitability of Iran's nuclear ambition, limited in scope as it is to purely civilian purposes, and inclusive of a uranium enrichment capability derived from its mastering of the nuclear fuel cycle in its entirety. This program can either be monitored by the international community in accordance with the provisions contained within the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or in a less intrusive manner per Iran's existing obligations under the NPT. The choice is the West to make. Either way, however, Iran will exercise its rights under the NPT to pursue a peaceful civilian nuclear program. And no amount of threats from either Israel or the United States can stop this.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that will affect the governments, communities, organizations and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the film industry in Pakistan has degenerated owing to the overwhelming influence of Bollywood and Hollywood. And we shall also take a look at the history of cinema in Pakistan, its ebbs and flows, how it lost talent to Bangladesh, and how political tensions with India affected filmmaking.
Pakistan's beleaguered film industry is desperately looking for a fresh lease of life, but the struggle seems to be real. Despite great expectations, the South Asian country's cinema has failed to live up to its massive potential, mostly mimicking Bollywood and Hollywood. Instead of churning out films in line with the country's rich socio-cultural values and traditions, as well as themes people can relate to, the Pakistani cinema industry, known as Lollywood, has settled to being a rehashed version of overseas cinema.
The Pakistani cinema industry, now approaching 75 years of its existence, is still struggling to carve a niche for itself in the global entertainment sector. The reasons are plenty, but analysts mainly point to Lollywood being overshadowed by Bollywood and Hollywood, lack of technology, unimaginative screenwriting, and dwindling number of theaters in the country. The Pakistani film industry has failed to evolve on its own. In order to compete with its international counterparts, Lollywood has lost that Eastern touch to it. A top Pakistani actor, Hamza A. Abbasi, a few years ago lamented the impact that the Indian film industry has had in Pakistan and how filmmakers in Pakistan copy Bollywood. Some Pakistani filmmakers have in the past expressed fears of the Indian film industry smothering the Pakistani cinema and damaging the country's Islamic culture and norms. The fact that some private channels in Pakistan distribute and promote Indian films illegally has also incurred huge losses to Pakistani filmmakers. However, it wasn't like this always. Before the 1980s, Pakistan had a thriving film industry and films didn't copy India or the West. The themes were in line with the country's rich cultural ethos. Then the decline began, followed by the slow death, which gradually opened the floodgates for Bollywood and Hollywood in Pakistan.
We could talk about the uplifting or further developing or improving the declining situation, if we could think about the national solidarity or unanimity or something like that. And then everybody has to talk about, they have their social freedom, maybe their national rights or statutory rights, whatever it is. But again, there has to be a policy for the national identity, for the sake of the national representative and into the media. So this is what we are saying, is that what we can see, that there is a lack of a development. There is no chance of development unless there is some point where a substantiating or sufficient policy making is there.
After the Indian Army's airstrike in a tribal belt of Pakistan in early 2019, which led to heightened tensions between the two strange neighbors, Indian films were quickly pulled out of cinemas in Pakistan. For the past 3 years, Pakistani cinema has struggled to fill the vacuum. To make up for the loss, Pakistani filmmakers have tried to replicate the formula of Indian and Western cinema based on so-called liberal themes. As a result, the new films coming out from Pakistan have faced intense scrutiny for promoting wrong values and culture.
In an indication of how Bollywood and Hollywood have overshadowed Pakistan's ailing film industry, the Muslim-majority country's filmmakers have been trying to use the ingredients of Indian and Western cinema to churn out new Lollywood movies. In India and the U.S., which together account for an overwhelming majority of films produced globally, the so-called liberal themes, promoting vulgarity, immorality, and sleaze, dominate the New Age cinema. Instead of reviving their own traditions and customs through films and creative art, Pakistani filmmakers appear to have fallen into a vicious trap. Former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan had expressed his misgivings over the growing trend of vulgarity dished out by Hollywood, Bollywood, laying stress on the cinema that promotes Islamic values and teachings. He even instructed his special assistant to work on a blueprint to revive the country's film industry away from the ominous shadows of Bollywood and Hollywood. However, the juggernaut rolls on.
This is a very well understood that Imran Khan was one of the great politicians in the history of Pakistan. He's still, and no wonder he can come back and take the office. However, his concern about the the copying Hollywood or Bollywood, it has many many meanings. We could interpret into many directions. For example, Imran Khan was against the production of the blind following of Hollywood or Bollywood, because there are some differences definitely at the national level, at the international level, which that make Pakistani audience as well as the Pakistani media quite identical as compared to the other film industries, for example, Bollywood or Hollywood. They have their own standards, they have their own policies, they have their own ways and methods, and they have their own cultures and ethnic standards, maybe, whatever. But that's Imran Khan's meaning, was that Pakistani film industry has to develop its own identity into this competitive profession.
More recently, a Pakistani film, Joyland, which became the country's first ever entry at the Cannes Film Festival, appeared to glorify the transgender culture, much to the chagrin of Pakistan's majority Muslim population and clergy. The controversial film has rekindled the debate over the decay of Pakistani cinema.
The partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947, besides spawning the worst humanitarian disaster, tremendously altered the landscape of film industries in the two countries. While India lost some great talent, Pakistan had to build the industry from scratch. With a strong foundation, the Indian film industry took giant strides over the years. Pakistani cinema, on the other hand, took smaller but measured steps. Quite remarkably, though, political tensions between the two countries had a ripple effect on their respective cinemas, too.
Following the partition of British India in 1947, filmmaking in the newly founded Pakistan suffered due to a lack of equipment and talent, as most noted artists and directors moved to India. In India, big cities such as Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras emerged as cinema hubs, but Pakistan only had Lahore as the major film center. The two major studios in the city were destroyed in the post-partition riots, leaving Pakistan's film industry without proper funding or specialized infrastructure.
From the partition in the year of 1947, we can see is that there was no, not any infrastructure available for Pakistan at national level to make films. So it took them 3 years to make a complete mechanism or a system to make movies. And then from 1950 all the way down to the late 70s, they made pretty good hits. You could say they were the good blockbusters. Even the neighboring countries they were following, and there have been at least 8 movies that have been made following by Pakistani cinema. The Pakistani cinema produced it, and they were remade into the Bollywood movies. At least 8, right? So till late 70s, the industry was flourishing. The people were performing, and the industry was growing, but because of the General Zia's regime, who took the power, and as an army general who brought the martial law into effect, there came a complete halt into the any production of film industry because of his so-called Islamization.
Years after the independence, there was an attempt to ban Indian films in Pakistan to help the local film industry gain foothold and flourish. It didn't happen until 1965, when the second war between the two estranged neighbors prompted then-Pakistani military general Mohammad Ayub Khan to ban Indian films. More than 40 years later, in 2005, another military ruler, General Parvez Musharraf, lifted the ban. In 2019, India accused Pakistan of orchestrating a terrorist attack in Kashmir's Pulwama, which was followed by India's surgical strike inside Pakistan. It led to the reinstatement of the ban on Indian films in Pakistan. To fill the vacuum, Pakistani filmmakers quite imprudently started copying Bollywood, even at the risk of losing their own substance.
Comparatively, Pakistan and India are in the similar situation like England and America, with the same languages. England today can never make an Indiana Jones, but England still makes a Shakespeare in Love and get recognized. So we have the same chance. We will not be able to make a Dabang 2, but we will be able to make a Shakespeare in Love in the future.
Pakistan's film industry had a purple patch in the 1960s and 70s when around 170 movies were produced annually, including colour films. The number has nosedived to less than 20 a year now. Many experts attribute the downfall to the separation of East Pakistan, which later came to be known as Bangladesh, in March 1971. Bengali actors and directors were instrumental in the development of Pakistan's cinema. Apart from losing creative people and skilled technicians, the film industry in Pakistan was also deprived of a big market and production center.
The 1960s, which is widely regarded as the golden period of Pakistani cinema, recorded an impressive growth of films and film stars. During this period, the country's film industry opened up to local and international markets, reaping great dividends.
Today's filmmakers, since they're starting from scratch, they don't have any continuity with the old filmmakers, they're in a conflict. They don't know exactly what a good film these days would be in Pakistan. Should it be the old-fashioned social drama, with lots of masala and songs? Should it be just a comedy to distract people from what's happening in Pakistan? Or should it be a comment, a pointed comment on what's happening in Pakistan? So they're still searching exactly for the right formula. And it'll come. It'll come.
In 1971, almost 400 cinemas functioned across the country, a quarter of them in East Pakistan. A year before, 114 films alone were produced in what later came to be known as Bangladesh. The separation of East Pakistan in 1971 dealt a heavy blow to Pakistan's flourishing film industry. It took decades for it to recover, only to fall into the Bollywood trap. The cinema industry in Bangladesh also had to start from scratch. It did well in the beginning, but faced similar hurdles as Pakistan did after the 1947 partition. Over the past five decades, it has struggled for survival, prompting Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in March this year to allocate a special fund for the revival of the country's film industry.
First of all, the government has to allocate some financial budget, the substantiating monetary support. This is the first thing. Second thing is they have to work for bringing in the latest technology into the industry, and then they have to introduce the well-qualified people, the directors and actors and whosoever takes it, the scriptwriters, the storytellers, the plot setters, whatever it takes. They have to. We have to bring in the technology like a computer, the graphic designers, the animators. It has to be a lot to bring everything together. And then what another important thing is that there has to be competitive benefits, the remuneration for the actors, the great, the talented people, so they can come, they, instead of going abroad and performing for other places, if they have great benefits right there in their, at their home ground, definitely it will make a huge difference.
Experts, however, have cautioned Bengali filmmakers not to fall into the Bollywood trap like Pakistan and risk losing its essence. For both neighbors, the mantra of success lies in charting their own journeys independent of Bollywood and Hollywood.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, let's begin with why has Pakistan's film industry failed to live up to its potential despite its artistic talent, intelligence audience, and ample resources?
It's a huge historical perspective behind that. In fact, Pakistan film industry, my elder brothers were involved in film industry. I know very well. I know those directors, those who were well-renowned as well, and they made some remarkable films as well. One, apart from my brother and his colleagues, I know one known as Zia Sarhadi. He was born in India, but settled in Pakistan. Then later he had to leave Pakistan because of his talent. In fact, his write-ups and his films as well, because of the martial law and dictators and all that. So similar story are like, for example, those who survived within Pakistan, they made some good film, feature film, but not very politically. If you touch political topics, then it's a problem. That's a basic issue of Pakistan industry falling up. Also, especially, I won't go far behind, but since 80s, when Ziaulhaq, the dictator who came in power, and during his era, the worst thing has happened because there was no Netflix or no digital options available at that time. Only cinemas were available. When you don't have any cinemas, or when you don't have any films coming in with the good write-ups or good direction or good actors, and the topics are not relevant to the reality, so the industry went down. And I saw many things. I spoke to many people about this topic as well, some actors and all that. The thing is, when Pakistan came into existence or partition happened, many of the writers, directors, actors of that time, they are still icons, whether Riaz Shaheed or Iqbal Akhtar, whether Zia Sarhadi or many others, actors, Santosh, or you name it, so many were there. And they were making good films and they were having good attraction for Indian market at that time. Even after that, another era came up during those when the biggest screen was summed up. Then the television screen, Pakistan television dramas were up way above than even Bollywood, the Bombay film industry. And they were even copying or following the songs and also the theme and also the stories in the films. That was the aspect. I was part of the South Asian television phenomena, which we brought into Europe. And at that time, the biggest attraction was Pakistan television dramas and writers. So we had the good writers, we had the good talent, but the political scenario was against these things. And also extremism came up. Also the Afghan jihad, so-called, came up, and the mullah fanatics came up, and they wanted to close down everything which could have changed the society. So that was a major reason behind Pakistani film industry to go down.
Sir, former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan was a vocal critic of a Bollywoodization of the Pakistani film industry, which he blamed for promoting vulgarity and immorality. Now, do you think this concerns or his concerns were legitimate?
I don't take it 100%. The thing is, to support those fanatics or those close-mindedness or those people, those who were against these phenomena, to have their support, one has to address their issues in their way. So he was addressing, whereas he was very much known as a progressive and liberal person living in Western, but his reaction was not because he wanted to have those things. Those things will never change. The thing is, vulgarity is not because of vulgarity, it's because other means, other problem, despite in Pakistan there are so many political Islamic organizations, but Pakistan society is deteriorating badly because of not having openness, not having proper knowledge or education. So they're not addressing the right issues, but these issues related with vulgarity or whatever Imran has said or he promoted, I think they were just to have the edge on political side from those people, those who are in fact controlling Pakistan, not majority, but they are controlling through establishment and all that. So it was just to promote their ideas, not to address the right issues. That's how I take it.
Last but not least, sir, what does the future hold for Lollywood and how can it reclaim its lost glory?
Well, there's no doubt that we have wonderful writers. My personal friends, I'm a journalist, I'm into media, I'm in television, my family was in film. I'm part co-producer of this film and also I'm engaged with many of the filmmakers and directors from Lollywood and Bollywood as well, for Pakistan, India and other places, Bangladesh as well. But I do find it's difficult, even if we can make some film like Gulmakai, we cannot show it in Pakistan. We cannot address those issues which are good for the society. We cannot address those unless they make it okay. They are this establishment, unfortunately, holding not only politics, they are holding media, they're holding every aspect. You cannot get out of those things unless they agree to you. If they agree to anything, you can do everything. If they disagree to anything which is good, you cannot do anything. So unless those controls are not fading away, we'll not be able to grow or come out of this effect of Bollywood or even westernized film concepts. We have our own local concept and topics which we can address, and we can make good dramas, good films, good everything. But we are not there because of these unwanted controls.
There you have it, Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, sir. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Pakistani broadcast journalist Shifa Yousafzai cites former Premier Imran Khan as saying that Bollywood movies promote vulgarity and sexual abuse in Pakistan, which are not part of the country's culture. Mehwish Hayat, a Pakistani film and TV actress, says it's time for Pakistan's cinema industry to step up and counter the way it is shown in Hollywood and Bollywood, adding that they need films about Pakistan. A Pakistani-Canadian software developer, Harris Ahmed, writes to Pakistani actor and singer Ali Zafar, expressing hope that Pakistani cinema will create its own amazing genre, away from Bollywood and Hollywood. A Twitter user by the name Gustavo stresses that Pakistani cinema is on decline, adding that copy-pasting Bollywood is not working. Ikram Hussain, a Pakistani political activist, says the country must ban Bollywood and that local artists should be given incentives so that they promote their civilization.
And that was our episode about the downfall of Pakistan's film industry due to the unhealthy influence of Indian and Western cinema. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Scientists are warning that the prolonged and above-average temperatures gripping the Mediterranean Sea are causing a marine wildfire that could permanently alter the ecosystem and cause species extinction. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Gina McGuire Ryder. This article is published under the heading Mediterranean Sea Ecosystem Threatened by Heat-Induced Marine Wildfire, Scientists Warn. Here's the story. Scientists are warning that the prolonged and above-average temperatures gripping the Mediterranean Sea are causing a marine wildfire that could permanently alter the ecosystem and cause species extinction. David Diaz of the Spanish Oceanographic Institute told Le Monde, such ocean heat waves were the equivalent of underwater wildfires, with fauna and flora dying just as if they had been burnt. The region has suffered an extreme heat wave this month, producing record air temperatures and low winds, causing a significantly hotter and deeper layer of ocean surface water. As Reuters reported, the warmer air, along with shifting ocean currents and a stable sea surface, have warmed coastal Mediterranean waters several degrees Celsius beyond the average temperatures of 24 degrees Celsius to 26 degrees Celsius for this time of the year. Some of the highest water temperatures were recorded on the eastern coast of Corsica, which hit a peak of 30.7 degrees Celsius in July, more than 6 degrees Celsius warmer than normal for this time of the year. Spain's Balearic Islands and the Italian coast saw an increase of 5 degrees Celsius. Keep in mind, water has more than 4x the heat capacity of air, which means it's much harder for water to warm than air, tweeted Colin McCarthy from his U.S. Storm Watch account, adding, a 6.2 degrees Celsius sea surface temperature anomaly in the Mediterranean is simply astonishing. The Mediterranean Sea is considered a biodiversity hotspot by scientists, accounting for less than 1% of the world's ocean surface, but inhabited by about 10% of all marine species. Ruben Del Campo of the Spanish National Meteorological Service told Le Monde that the Mediterranean's native populations of corals, of shellfish, and of fish are suffering enormously. The Mediterranean hosts up to 20,000 marine species of fauna and flora, 25% of which are native to the region. The sea's endemic Posidonia and Neptune grasses play a vital role in the ecosystem by storing carbon. A hectare of the grass is capable of absorbing 15 times more carbon dioxide every year than a similarly sized piece of the Amazon rainforest. Emily Villar, a Marseille-based marine ecologist, told the La Provence, 700 Mediterranean species are threatened with extinction, and if the shock lasts too long or if the species is fixed and cannot migrate, others will fill the void, or if conditions become too harsh, the Mediterranean risks dying out. A recent study published in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society found that marine heat waves associated with the climate crisis have already destroyed up to 90% of coral populations in parts of the Mediterranean. Additionally, a World Wildlife Fund report last year found that water temperatures in the Mediterranean were rising 20% faster than the global average, making it the world's fastest warming sea. Karina von Schonkman, an oceanographer at the nonprofit research group Mercator Ocean International, said, since at least 2003, marine heat waves have become more common, and in future they will last longer, cover more sea, and be more intense and severe. Schonkman said the most effective course of action to mitigate marine heat waves is for governments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions contributing to global warming.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession. The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the U.K., France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is set to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapon to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give weapon to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries.
With the exception of four countries that are already, for historical reasons, very much linked to the United States from a military point of view, it means South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. All of the other countries here are quite difficult that they can enter in a kind of alliance, a military alliance, as the NATO in Europe. There are many, many reasons. Political reason, but also economic reason, because China is growing so fast and their economy, the economy of these countries, are very much interconnected with China One.
China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
Tensions are rising between China and the United States. Beijing has issued a stern warning against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Chinese Taipei. Beijing says that Washington will be responsible for the consequences of the possible visit. Chinese side has made it clear to the U.S. that it is firmly opposed to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. We are fully prepared. If the U.S. goes its own way, China will certainly take firm and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences.
So the idea that she would visit Taiwan at this point is intended to provoke a crisis with China. Recall that the U.S. and the British forced NATO expansion, totally ignoring Russia's security interests, with the so-called reverse Cuba Missile Crisis, whose purpose was to provoke Russia into acting against the neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine in order to justify the wildly illegal and self-defeating sanctions, economic warfare against Russia.
Analysts believe the latest warning by China against the visit of the U.S. House Speaker to Chinese Taipei was harsher in tone and very stern. Some say the threats contained an allusion to a possible military confrontation between China and the U.S., and that is why reservations have been raised in Washington about the visit. The U.S. House Speaker was scheduled to visit Taipei earlier in April, but the trip was apparently canceled after she contracted COVID. However, some reports say that Pelosi will make the controversial visit in August. Apart from top Democrats, some hawkish Republicans have also come out in favor of the visit, stressing that this visit is a show of support against China.
This is a very serious crisis. How China responds is very difficult to foresee, but it's a moment in which the literally madmen and women in the West are trying to do to China what they are in the process of doing against Russia.
There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. In terms of the economy, China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S.'s by the year 2030. In terms of military and technology, China is now a superpower on par with the U.S., although Washington's military budget is still the largest in the world. Politicians in Washington who are still dreaming of a unipolar world order that came into existence following the collapse of the Soviet Union, do not tolerate the rise of China. The first sign of the unease began to emerge after the former U.S. President Barack Obama announced his pivot to Asia policy, which was meant to counter China's rising influence. Obama's successors, Trump and Biden, have continued Washington's anti-China rhetoric. The two superpowers are locked over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea. The bone of contention is Chinese Taipei, and Beijing has made it very clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to become independent.
It really can only be averted at this point by the nations of the West recognizing that they have no solution to the now terminal breakdown of the dollar system, the hyperinflationary collapse, other than sitting down with Russia and with China in a new Bretton Woods conference to replace the now completely broken and destroyed Bretton Woods system that was set up by Franklin Roosevelt and has been systemically taken apart over these last 30 years.
Chinese Taipei is under China's sovereignty and under the One China policy. The United States and other countries have recognized that sovereignty. But Washington, in violation of its own stated policy, and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, has increased diplomatic contact with the Chinese Taipei.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran, but more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while carrying highly explosive bombs. Later, reports emerged that the espionage planned to blow up a sensitive facility in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. This, however, isn't the first time Israel had planned on carrying out acts of terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's intelligence ministry forces had also captured individuals linked to Mossad in April. The spies were involved in disseminating classified information and documents. In July, Iran arrested another network of agents while they were carrying a large cache of weapons and ammunition with the intentions of provoking riots and terror inside the country.
Earlier in March, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps foiled yet another Israeli act of terror. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it stopped an imminent Israeli plot to sabotage the Fordow uranium enrichment plant.
Israel has, however, conducted a few terrorist acts against Iran over the past years, namely the murder of top Iranian scientists and army generals and acts of sabotage on nuclear sites. Yet, interestingly enough, the regime continues such atrocities without being held accountable by the international community, and more specifically the U.S., who has supported Israel through its veto power in the United Nations Security Council.
The impunity with which Israel carries out such attacks or in this case, makes such plans, is fully enabled by the United States of America, which at this point, I believe, should be deemed responsible for the crimes and the destabilization that the apartheid state of Israel engages in. The primary way that the United States enables the crimes and the destabilization of Zionism and the colonialist apartheid state of Israel is through its veto in the United Nations. Since 1972, the United States has vetoed 53 resolutions attempting to hold Israel to account by way of international law.
Israel has been involved in a string of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years and has killed many top nuclear scientists and military officials in cowardly strikes. More recently, on May 22nd, Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai was assassinated by two motorcyclists who shot him 5 times before fleeing the scene. He was dismounting his car to enter his home in an eastern neighborhood of the Iranian capital when 3 bullets hit him in the head and 2 bullets in the hand. While Israel has yet to officially comment on the incident or take blame, all reports and facts indicated that it has so far been behind the terrorist activities in Iran. Regarding the Khodai case, American outlet The New York Times cited an intelligence official as saying that Israel has informed American officials that it was behind the assassination. Despite all this, the regime continues its petty attempts of trying to accuse Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel attacks its neighbors on almost a daily basis, for example, bombing Syria, whereas Iran has not attacked a neighboring country in over 300 years, or almost 300 years. Furthermore, the very well-known international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, have deemed Israel to be an apartheid state, which inherently, as such, destabilizes the region. So there's nothing new here in terms of the Israeli and American narrative, their propaganda regarding Iran. What I do see as new and heartening is the fact that the effectiveness of this narrative is weakening very rapidly.
Israeli atrocities have also garnered fierce response from Iranian officials. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has warned that Iran will take a harsh revenge on those who assassinated a member of the force in Tehran.
The commander of the Iranian army's ground force has warned that Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel makes any attempts against Tehran. Brigadier General Qumars Haydari also stated that Israeli occupied territories will be liberated in less than 25 years.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, public health agencies generally don't test sewage for polio. Instead, they wait for people to show up sick in doctors' offices or hospitals, a reactive strategy that can give this stealthy virus more time to circulate silently through the community before it is detected. Please stay with us for an article in this regard.